You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Well, not exactly troll on in this week, but fly on in. As a matter of fact, we had a great contingency from Hawaii, once again back east, talking story on a national basis about recreational and non-commercial fishing. We told you a little bit about it before. Josh DeMello is here. We got a special guest from NOAA that we're going to reintroduce to you in a moment. But kind of interesting, Josh, because I remember calling you or texting you or something, and you sent me back a picture of where you were. Kind of far away. What was this all about, and who went there?
So this was the National Saltwater Recreational Fishing Summit, okay. The third of its kind, back last week in Arlington, Virginia. So that's right outside of D.C.
A lot of people actually live in Arlington. They say they live in D.C., but they're really in Arlington, right?
Right, yeah. And it's home to the Pentagon, Crystal mm-hmm. City, and the Arlington Cemetery, where the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is.
Yeah. So good stuff. You guys get to go do the history thing. Most of you had been there before, though, right?
Well, mostly you're there for the meeting, so yeah. It's.
But that's like saying I'm in Vegas, but we're only going to the conference, right? Yeah. You got to find a few minutes to go out there and fool around. But I think that's great. And so this was obviously convened there. It's people from all over the country were there.
Yeah. So yeah. So all of the U.S. EEZ regions. So we had. There were folks from Alaska mm-hmm. and from Alaska all the way down to Florida and Maine all the way down to American Samoa. So we brought over some of the folks from American Samoa and Guam as well as Hawaii mm-hmm. to participate because we really are a unique breed of fishermen out in this side of the world. And we wanted to make sure that it was known to them so that if something comes up, we're not lumped into that category.
Yeah, that's really great. And that's why at like the Fishers Forums, part of the Westpac meeting, is our fisher folks here are realizing, wow, I had no idea that we had some people actually on our side in some of these issues. It's not all them and us.
Yeah, it's really, it's for us, it's fishing is fishing is fishing. And and whether we call ourselves commercial, non-commercial, charter, scuba spear, or lay gill net. We're all participating in our tradition.
Okay, so the big picture, and many of you know that the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council is a unique, well, all the councils are very, very unique in their structure. And that's because they're a quasi, you know, a federal agency. I mean, however, the management is bottoms up, and that's what's really important. And one of the guys that we met a while ago, is rejoining us today. He is with the department, the commerce side of NOAA. Andrew Torres is here, and we're trying to figure out Andrew when the last time he was here. It was a while ago.
Yeah, I want to say it was the late 2017.
But what I did learn when you told me what the topic of this summit was: improving opportunities and stability in recreational fisheries. I guess exactly hitting the nail on the head is that there's a lot of people that was perceived that NOAA and fisheries and everybody else was all about commercialism, didn't care about the little guy, and that's, from what I've learned, 100% the opposite.
Yeah, so as Josh said, this is the third of its kind in terms of the summit, mm-hmm. and if we do the math on this, is that this effort really started back around 2009, 2010. In that there was a recognition that the recreational, and we're going to be careful about how we say recreational.
Yeah, especially
because
in Hawaii,
we're here,
right?
With the non-commercial, And so that, and as Josh has already said, that, you know, that led to the formation or the creation of an action agenda, which eventually became an implementation plan and something that we reported out at this recent summit. So the first one in 2010, 2014, and so it looks like every 4 years.
And to me, it looks like, you know, and Josh, you can jump this one too. It looks like I don't want to say the mission's changed, but now that there's some history, you're able to see maybe, wow, why we're glad this is happening because it wasn't there before. Now it's a component that's used all the time.
And I think it's more about fine-tuning what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Because now that NOAA has more formally embraced recreational fishing, mm-hmm. we can actually say, okay, so now here's recreational fishing. What can we do to help it? And there were things that we talked about, like electronic reporting on providing the data from the from the recreational fishermen back into things like stock assessments mm-hmm. and catch limits.
Yeah, I think this is really cool. But and obviously, you guys both would have been asked different questions of different family and friends that were there. But what I'm more interested in, and maybe Andrew, you can help share that, is what you learned from your peers from other areas of NOAA's, you know. NOAA's an octopus to most of us. I mean, it just grabs the whole country. But yet, there seems to be, at this sort of a deal, a lot more interplay so that you can see and differentiate when you said we got to be careful between commercial, recreational. Are other areas as, I don't know, as dependent on fishing as we are?
I don't know that it's a matter of dependence as mm-hmm. much as it is uniqueness.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So the my predecessors did really well in their involvement in getting that message across, is that, you know, we don't play with our food. And what was very interesting and encouraging to me was that mm-hmm. at the very beginning, the national coordinator, Russ Dunn, mm-hmm. Made it a point to mention that we recognize that it's not all about recreational fishing yeah. per se, as because we also want to include the importance culturally yeah. of non-commercial fishing. And that was
laugh.
A big step.
I got to laugh because I've got a friend that keeps a fishing outfit in his truck. And sometimes when he's on his way home from work, he has a couple of spots if the water's nice. He pulls over and he catches a fish. And people think that this guy is just going down there to, you know, recreate. And he is, but he also is thinking, maybe I can catch dinner. And there's a big difference, isn't there, between a guy that's going to kiss that fish and let him go back again and the guy that's going to put it in his frying pan.
Yeah, because there's another thing that came. There are a bunch of good comments. And this is, I think, what's good about folks getting together like that mm-hmm. from different regions. Because the other thing that one of the panelists was pleading for is that don't take the fun out of fishing.
Mm-hmm.
We'll
yeah.
make the claim, yeah. you know, that we fish for food.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the other aspect of this is that, you know, with the government, you know, doing what it does,
yeah.
is that if we're looking at innovative ways of collecting data that's necessary for effective management, is that at some point don't make it so cumbersome that you take the fun out yeah. of that whole process.
But one of the charts that I looked at was how important fish is for you as far as being part of your diet. Do you rely, or do you need, or are you obligated to go and catch some fish or buy some fish or trade for some fish? In other words, I'm not sure that other regions are as consumed the same amount per pound of, say, of seafood a year as we do here.
Yeah,
is there anybody that eats more fish than us?
We are one of the highest regions that yeah. with per capita consumption of seafood.
And especially when you go to the far reaches of the council, right? When you get out in the Pacific Islands and some of the other places.
Well, yeah. when you don't have McDonald's in your island, or yeah. maybe you have McDonald's, but you don't have McDonald's, Jack in the Box, and Wendy's, and Burger King.
All
and
on the
else.
Same street in the same corner.
I kind of liken it to hunting, mm-hmm. where there's those hunters that will go out just to shoot a lion or a giraffe or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they're not going to eat the meat. Mm-hmm. But then there's also those hunters that go out and they're there to hunt for a pig or a deer or something, mm-hmm. but they're there to eat it. They have fun, but yeah, they're there yeah. to provide food.
Well, one of the other things, Andrew, and I know that you're going to love this, is let's say papillo are running, and you get a guy that's going to go catch papillo, and he actually can eat four, but he's going to catch 12, but he's going to release eight of them. I mean, I think that's what makes us a little bit different. And don't we have to educate the person that catches and keeps all 12? Wait. You know, unless you know somebody's going to eat this, don't have it in your fridge for a few days and then toss it. In other words, catch the three that you want to eat and catch some more, but let them go.
Yep. I think we've done well over the years.
I think so, too.
Yeah, to convey that message. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing I want to bring up is that this was high-level stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When you consider that we had the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, appear and give a speech about the importance of seafood to the nation.
Yeah.
And that there's some high number, maybe you can correct me, it's like 90% of the seafood that we consume is actually imported.
Yeah, it's a scary number. But I think you pointed out one thing, Josh. It's skewed a little bit because some of the things that are considered seafood that are in that percentage aren't available in the U.S. So, I mean, you know, for instance, the gross amount of shrimp and some other things that sway that. But it still is significant, isn't it, that we don't catch most of our fish. We bring them in from somewhere.
Right. Yeah. And so Hawaii's is a little bit less. Hawaii, yeah, we actually catch a lot more than mm-hmm. than the average. So ours is like 60-70% imports or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important for us because we don't have shrimp that yeah. kind of, you know, yeah. the tiger shrimp or scallops yeah. or salmon, mm-hmm. even salmon for Lomi yeah. Lomi salmon. You're not going to get around it. You're going to have to import it.
People never got that in the beginning, right? They thought, well, it's at the luau's. You must catch it in the no. And it wasn't ever at the luau's before it was brought in. It wasn't that salt salmon.
Salt salmon.
I mean, so but by the time they brought it in, all they had to do was throw some vegetables because it's plenty salty already.
Right.
Yeah. But interesting, right? As far as and I guess Andrew, maybe you can point out at the number of the assets that are spent to do this. In other words, this is not casual stuff. This is, you know, very heavy scientific stuff that you guys put together. So it must be a big budget, a big line item on the budget to do this particular part of what NOAA does in the Pacific Islands region, Pacific particularly.
Yeah, this is where it gets interesting because mm-hmm. on the one hand, you are correct in that mm-hmm. assumption that we need the information, we need the data, and mm-hmm. that collecting that data gets to be expensive. But the other half of that conversation is that our budget really does, you know, we don't know. There's not that certainty there. It gets more and more expensive.
Yeah.
And so one of the intents of this summit was to take advantage of or have a discussion about how the fishermen themselves can participate in contributing data and collecting data.
I love that. Yeah.
What new platforms do we have? What challenges do we face in terms of the data that they choose or that they are willing to provide? Now, fishermen are finicky that way. Yeah. On the one hand, they like to keep their secret spots secret. Mm. On the other hand, we need that information to make informed management decisions.
But haven't we reached a little bit better place when people are not saying, well, what are you going to do for me? Because they realize that the information that's been collected and gathered so far, and Josh, I don't quite know how to ask this question, but here's my thought. As long as we do what we do in Hawaii that's different, if we know that what we're doing is sustaining, isn't this where your stock assessments and all of that become so important for my listeners to be honest on what that is? Because, yeah, we want to keep you eating, but we also need to be making sure that we're stewards of the ocean so that we're not allowing us to catch and eat one species into extinction.
I think a lot of it comes down to what do fishermen want? And mm-hmm. and I think that was one of the points of this summit, was to figure out what do they want, what do fishermen want to reveal, what can they live with, and providing that type of data that we need for management is actually one of the keys of this whole summit. Because what I learned is that some of those guys on the East Coast, it's really bad, the data that they've been either been giving or the numbers that come out of the models have been things that they can't live with. So you have this a lot of negativity towards the management. And so if you think things are bad here, you should look at something like the red snapper fishery in the Gulf of Mexico.
Amen. Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that I know that we hold a lot of hopes, Andrew, on. Like if you've seen what's happened, say, in places like the Alawai or places like Kaneohe or Waikiki, that where it will come back. But when it gets to a certain point, it's pretty difficult to do that, right?
It's difficult to do that if you don't include the fishermen as part of the solution.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Because one of the other common themes across the nation is that the fishermen do not like to consider themselves to be demonized to some extent mm-hmm. and also disenfranchised from the process. And that, and I think we've done well, too. That's been brought up on numerous occasions over the years, which is basically they want to be included in the discussion. They are a part of the solution, for that matter. And so, and when you consider that they too rely on the stability of that fisheries to continue what they do at all the levels, commercially, non-commercially, recreationally.
Yeah, and I let me tell you, I love that. So obviously everybody goes to these things with anticipation and goals, and then when you get there, walk us through actually the chain of events. What happens? I mean, you all can gain the convergence sounds good, improving the opportunity and stability of recreational fishery. What were the tools that you had, and when, more importantly than that, when are the results going to be available so people have contributed know that that we're growing fruit here?
Okay. Again, consider that you have different people from different regions that are unique, right? But what they did well was the structure of the summit itself was based on discussion input provided by the participants around One topic of a breakout session was innovative management alternatives and approaches. You know, what have we tried? What has worked? What has not worked? Another breakout session had to do with angler engagement, including the fishermen in data collection and reporting. Mm-hmm. That's another big piece right there. And the final breakout session had to do with expanding recreational fishing opportunity through conservation. And that's a tough one to wrap your head around because it's almost kind of like, well, which is it?
Yeah.
One or the other.
Yeah.
But there is something to be said about that. And before we went out there, we convened a meeting at the council office to be prepared, essentially. You know, let's talk about what we have tried out here that we would consider otherwise innovative. And it had to do with some of those community-based subsistence fishing areas. And that this was a shot at something. Yeah. We were trying something, but the jury's out as to whether or not did it really work. And I think another component of fisheries management is that, well, if it doesn't work, what adjustments have to be made, if any, to make it successful? Or do you just cut your losses? That's a separate discussion to have.
Yeah.
And again, recall that, you know, you have the federal connection and you have the state connection, and then there's going to be at some point a collaboration between the two. NGOs and the fishing advocates.
Yeah, and you know, Josh, and I know that's where the big concern of our fishery goes. I mean, you know, especially when doing that. But one of the things that that Andrew just mentioned is the community-based management. We're going through a lot of experimentation with that, right? And I know the council is really deep involved in it. I mean, we have a look like what's happening on Molokai at Hyena, Niihau, and some of these other places where they're trying to work out a system where you can protect the assets and the icebox, if you will, of the guys that are there, but you will also not prevent people, other stakeholders or other members of the fishery to also participate.
I think for community-based management, it's really about the people that know the area should really be there and be able to set those types of regulations for that area because they know that area better than anyone else.
Especially when you talk about species, right? Certain fish, times of the year, breeding season, that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah, and I think the part that we really get lost on is that not everyone that knows that area has been included in that discussion about what's best for that area. And it doesn't mean that just the people who are living there on that shoreline or near in that community are the only ones that use that area. There are people who from maybe the other side of the island that use that area or are dependent on that area. And we've seen that through things like fish flow studies and other things that we're learning about where fish go.
When you guys were at the meeting, either one of you can answer this. Were there similar concerns from other areas where people were trying to protect a specific piece of geography from others coming and fishing there? Because I know that, say, in Alaska, there's some Native Indians that they think they own all the salmon going up that creek in their neighborhood and they don't want somebody else there.
I can think it's somewhat related because we had Richard Yamada was one of the participants from the Alaska region.
Mm-hmm.
And what may be related here is that here's a situation where his business, and I believe a lot of Hawaiians actually signed up or visited his lodge.
Oh, yeah, a lot.
And what they were up against was I think the recreational quota allocation for halibut that's necessary for the success of his business was such that it put on some serious limitations. But what was innovative was the successful effort to purchase allocation from the commercial sector. And so this is a good example
of something in reverse of what we're usually thinking, right?
Right. Well, innovative to the extent that well, if you can sell it to us, it's going to be valuable. Both are going to benefit from this discussion and this agreement. And it's something that seems to be successful. And I think this is the sort of thing there.
And maybe it's the sustainability of the species is also guaranteed by that because there's that cooperation job. Isn't that kind of like what's happening in Samoa, where some of the smaller boats can't fish so that they're going to change their rights with our longline fleet so that their inshore fishery can be improved with the money that our longline fleet pays for them? It's got nothing to do with fish.
Well, that's part of the issue for the large vessel prohibited area in American Samoa. And actually, they're looking at things like, hey, maybe we should be helping the government or persuading the government to open the National Marine Monument out in the Pacific remote islands, because that was an area where their fishermen, their big boats could go and fish. And if the big boats can go fish out there, then maybe we can save more of our area around here so we don't have to share.
Yeah, it's like it's trading. It really is trade. And that's kind of interesting because if you take a look, Andrew, many people don't understand. And we point people at WPCouncil.org all the time. But there is such a wealth of information available from NOAA on the web. I mean, I would imagine that you get people are literally clicking on NOAA around the world all the time for this stuff.
You know, I don't know what those numbers are. I know that locally, it's something that's high on my list of things to accomplish. Yeah, as I get my feet under me, and as I get a better understanding of how the pieces fit together out here, is that that's the sort of thing that I hope. In fact, that'll be the measure of success: is how many people are, how many more people are participating.
Yeah, no, who gets engaged? I mean, that's how we gain every show that we do. We track email, we track comments on what people want to know. And as to be honest, and I think I've shared this with Josh before. Once the council picked up partial sponsorship of this program, it's given us some of the more meaty content so that we're not just talking about, say, tournaments or what color to catch the Mai Mai with or this kind of stuff, but we're talking about stuff where people can give and take. And I think we've seen that at the officious forums, Josh, where we're getting a different kind of person that's coming now. So isn't the same thing of this dissemination of the information that happened at this, isn't that going to give us a whole bunch of more either followers or certainly interested parties, we hope.
And if we can come up with those sound bites of what went on there.
Yeah, I love that.
Instead of a full 46-page report or something that will probably come out with it, something that people can look at, has a nice picture of a fish, and go, oh, that's what happened. I think that's probably be the most helpful thing.
Well, you know, we think in this instant gratification, give us this the cliff notes. I mean, you know, just give us what's the tweet on this? But I think that what we've learned, and I don't know, Andrew, how you would react, but Josh and I, we were at this forum, the last Fishers Forum, and during the discussion, it was a panel of us folks from the media, and you know, TV, radio, me, and you know, newspaper, Civil Beat was there. Let's go Hawaii. Go, I mean. Hawaii Fishing News was there. And one at the end of the conversation, Josh, a 12-year-old girl put her hand up. She wanted to ask a question. And she said, and it was right after something either me or Catherine Cruz from Public Radio said. And she said, well, I'm so-and-so. I don't listen to the radio. And I'm thinking, okay, well, who's the vice president? I think that aren't we talking about that kind of thing? That people, they need, like Josh just said, if not a soundbite, a website, something that they can go and click in, go right to the thing they're interested in, get their info, and then move along.
Yeah, so we have to figure out what
what's the button?
Yeah, what's the button? Yeah. What's the platform? What's the social media platform that we work off that's most efficient and effective at reaching out to most of the people? And the other thing that I am recognizing is that there's also going to be issues that folks are going to rally around on both sides of the argument of the discussion. Yeah. A recurring theme, though, is the matter of trust. And if you're looking for that soundbite, and that's something that Kurt Kawamoto provided, is that if you want to get the trust from the fishermen, tell the truth.
Yeah.
Begin
Amen.
With the truth.
Yeah,
and there was something to that. And so that's the sort of thing. So it may be in the form of transparency in the process. It certainly includes, well, it's inclusion, participation by both sides of the discussion. But that's a key piece for much of our effort going forward is what level of trust can we secure? Well, we're going to start by telling the truth.
Yeah. And, you know, by the way, once again, we have to make sure that a lot of folks understand. We were talking off the air before we convened today that there are, if you go charter boat fishing here in Hawaii, the charter boat, there'll be a sign usually inside the cabin that says, you know, the crew works for fish and tips, you know, and that means that the crew is going to sell the catch at the end of the day. And Josh, when you said earlier, people got to understand this, that the number, the effort and the fish that are being caught by the charter fleet has a direct bearing on the entire catch of the area, right? That information is valuable, and that customers, that local people, excuse me, this is kind of wandering. Local people expect when they go fishing on a charter boat, they take the fish home. And then they find out, wait, sometimes you do, but sometimes you don't. If you want to be, you know, honest, the boat needs to sell the fish. But how does that fish get counted? Is that a fish caught by a guy that wanted to go out and fun, or is it counted by the captain and the crew that are selling it or eating it.
So in Hawaii, you actually need to have a commercial marine license to be a charter fisherman.
Right.
So the boat
so
would
they're considering
actually
you commercial.
Right. So the boat would actually record what they caught and more importantly, how long it took them to catch it, how many gear hours or what gear they used. And but there are also other places where it might be someone who's interviewed. Some of the charter captains in say the Gulf of Mexico are actually interviewed, and even their passengers who come off the boat are interviewed, which was a problem when they started doing it here because they've been fishing all day. Sometimes maybe they got skunked or
they're not happy,
or they're seasick or something, and you're going to be harassing these customers that are coming off the boat. But there's also opportunities for interviewing them on the phone or by mail with the National Saltwater Angler Registry as well. So if you fish, you're supposed to have that in federal waters. You're supposed to have that as well.
You know, what's interesting to me, and maybe, Andrew, this has got a lot to do with the difference between us locally and them. I've been in Alaska and other places where you may be fishing in a creek with a friend or something, and all of a sudden the guy walks up in the uniform, he's got the badge, and he wants to look at your stuff and look at your tags and look at your license. And there's no resistance. People, they expect that. That's not happened here. It was defeated again in the ledge this year. The fishery that we're not going to be, you know, counting ourselves in licensing. Is there this fear that with that is control or they're going to find out stuff about me that I don't want? Do you think that? And I'm not asking you if you're for or against this thing, but aren't we kind of unique in that respect that we're the only state that doesn't have a recreational fishing license?
Hawaii, and it'd be the same for the other territories, Guam, Sinaloa, and American Samoa.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a big, leap of faith or a big consideration. Mm. It also poses challenges because, you know, we need that information. We have done well through the boater registration for Hawaii to identify that list of the fishing community that fishes. You can pretty much guess it's going to be offshore if it's from a fishing vessel. The difficulty is in how do we determine or identify that same group for the inshore fishery? And so that's something that's being worked on now. That's a separate conversation, I think another meeting sometime in the future. But as it relates to, again, if we get back to the theme of that summit, which is to improve opportunity and stability, that's a key piece right there. I think the other thing that's emerging, especially for our region, is that we don't do well to assign blame as much as it is. If we focus on working on responsibility, so it's one thing to be able to keep the billfish that you catch as a local. What else? Where else can you contribute? How can you fit in? Because again, the intent is not to assign blame, but you know, play your part to maintain that stability in the very fishery that you rely on.
Yeah, and I think that's really positive. And I know that in a perfect world, we'd all just embrace each other and say, okay, this is really good. I still think, though, that we there's still Josh, and you know, because we've been doing this together for such a long time now. And by the way, Josh Jamello is a fishery analyst with the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, blah, 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 at wbcouncil.org. And that's his hat. And he is also responsible for the content of what we do here. Andrew, on the other side, is from Papa Bear, from NOAA. And I think I should have asked this before. Explain how NOAA is as interested in the council as the council is in NOAA. I'm talking about the fishermen. All of a sudden, I'm supposed to embrace this Uncle Noah that I didn't know before. Now that I'm learning a little bit more, hey, this guy's not so bad. These are nice people. They're just like us, you know?
So do I have nine years? How many years you've been on this show? Okay.
But, you know, I mean, it's before, if you just said to somebody at a party, what do you do? Oh, I work for the IRS. The guy's in the other direction. Yeah. Or I'm a policeman. Whoop, see ya. This fear factor that maybe used to exist is I think, dissipating. Or I'm hoping that's what we do this for, right?
So as I mentioned, as I get my feet under me and I understand how the pieces are fitting together, and they are beginning to fit together, is that it seems that NOAA would do well, or the idea that you looked to Big NOAA to solve the problems, I think is part of the problem, because we're much better at providing the tools necessary. Yeah. And I think it's up to the people, the constituents, to come up with the solutions And my role, if as I see it presently, until told otherwise, is that it's more of an interface between what the national policy is, what the state intent is, what the local populations and the cultures and communities are aspiring to do, is that we're more that interface to bring the parties together to collaborate on a solution. Because the federal nexus, we were just talking about this on the way in, you know, what role do we have? You know, why are, we're not going to tell the state what to do, but as it relates to protected species issues, monk seals, seabirds to an extent, marine mammals, that sort of thing. There's that aspect of it. And there's another key piece, which is it's the economic contribution of recreational non-commercial fishing, at least in my world.
Yeah, I also think, and Josh, we've talked about this before, the economic impact is very important to know. But in actual fact, there are many people here among us, and certainly listen to this program, that have a dependency on the fishery. I mean, it's not, it's just, they don't just fish just for fun. They fish sometimes because they really need to, you know, especially maybe summertime when the kids are all home. If you're making cans of tuna every day, and all of a sudden you find out, well, wait, if I go out and catch some tuna and make it in little chunks and freeze it up, I'm not going to spend $1.50 a can. I'm going to spend 50 cents a can or whatever it is. It's, in other words, it's important to the economy of the state, not just the, not just the recreational side of it.
And the Secretary Ross recognized that when he
was talked, that cool having him doing that. Yeah,
He talked about the a recent survey done on the economics of recreational fishing and recreation, outdoor recreation as a whole, and the number was just amazingly high, something like 30-something billion dollars to the economy.
Did it surprise everybody?
It surprised me, and I hope it surprised everyone else. Well, we deal in the hundreds of millions of dollars here, so so that's just an order of magnitude bigger than what what our known world deals with.
Well, I think maybe, and it's sheer numbers, Andrew, right? I mean, I think in Hawaii, percentage-wise, there are more of us involved somehow in the fishery than in other places. But the money that's spent on recreational fishing on the mainland, especially with gear and licensing and all of that stuff, is a staggering amount of money.
It is. Yeah. You know, if I work with, and I have actually numbers in front of me here, which is nationally in 2015, using 2015 numbers, we're looking at 9 million saltwater anglers went on 61 million saltwater fishing trips that resulted in 440,000 jobs and $63 billion in sales. And that's nationally.
Yeah.
Now, I have the local figures here. So for Hawaii, and this is where it gets a little bit tricky, which is why we're working on trying to figure out how to get a more accurate number. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates by, and I'm not sure what survey that is that that we have about 155,000 saltwater anglers. And I think that's more on the low side.
I do too.
And that the Marine Recreational Information Program has it pegged closer to almost 400,000 saltwater anglers. And that makes that's, that seems to be closer. But 900 jobs in Hawaii. And $119 million in sales. And there are downstream effects and revenue generation, that sort of thing. And so these are big numbers. And again, that's that federal nexus to keeping close track and advocating for improvement of opportunity and stability in non-commercial fishing.
In the very beginning part of the conversation, Josh DeMello, you mentioned cross-section of the people we're talking about. We got the whippers, we got the freshwater guys, we got the divers, we got everybody involved. And in many cases in Hawaii, we do all these things. We might be a pig hunter once every 5 years, but we are a pig hunter. We might be a offshore fisher once every 2 years, but we might go whipping every week.
Right.
So, I mean, so the number actually, I would agree with Andrew. We're talking about probably half the state somehow involved in it. That's 500,000 people.
And if you think about who else is involved in recreational fishing, not just that guy that actually throws the pole. It's the person that sells the ice at the store.
Oh, yeah.
It's the person that provides the tackle at one of the tackle shops, or even the bigger stores like Walmart or Long's or something. And then you have the people who are enjoying the fish once they give it. It's not just the family. It's maybe it might be the neighbors or friends or someone else.
Yeah, and that's why we are unique. And you go to wpcouncil.org for more of that. NOAA has all kinds of opportunities. But what I want to close it today, because Andrew Torres is here, I want to go back to this the information you gave me from 2015 I think that this is a pretty interesting, when it comes down to in the bottom there, there's a fish that's shaded, and it's the amount of people that depend on the fishery by percentage. I think that's a real wake-up call about how many people depend or rely on fish.
Right, and so this is, you know, credit due to the folks over at the Science Center, the Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center, just in Hospital Shop, in that from the 2015 Hawaii Non-Commercial Fishing Attitudes and Preferences Survey.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's a surprising as much as it is validating that.
No, that's what I'm getting at. When, here it is in black and white. Here's the way it is. We've been thinking about it. Now here's the proof.
Yeah. So if the question is, how important are the fish you catch to your regular diet? Mm-hmm. Is that 36% of those surveyed viewed it as extremely or very important? And 28% viewed it as somewhat important to their diet.
That's,
so
that that's by like a big whack.
Is, you know, already over 50%. Yeah. So that is in terms of the level of importance to our fishing communities or to our culture.
Yeah.
There it is.
But, you know, Josh, it shows you how lucky we are, because our catch amount is small, but the value of it is very high. And that's because I think that we consumers in Hawaii are more discerning and more demanding on the fish because of, I don't know whether it's culture or ethnicity or whatever. I want a fresh piece of fish, and I'm willing to pay for it, but I really need to know it's safe.
And it's because we've grown up with fish, or not just literally grown up with fish, but the culture itself has been dependent on fish for so long that we know what fresh fish is, and we know the difference of having that fresh fish and then World War II, and we got all this canned Spam and and corned beef and everything. And so even now, moving into the more foodie generations of having this fancy kind of food, that fresh fish is still there. So something like poke, which is like all the rage in the mainland now.
It's huge. Like, stop it already. We, you know, we want to keep the fish here.
It's like, we already knew that. We've been eating it for generations.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, we've just scratched the tip of the iceberg here, but I think that obviously, Josh, and same with you, Andrew, this must have been not only a worthwhile trip, but it's just another step down the road of making people understand how, not necessarily how unique we are, but how many people are looking after our interests. It's not just us. We have a lot of help.
Yep. Yeah. You know, and so I'd like to close with, there were two comments that were made that, for me, were take-home messages. In that, one, don't underestimate the potential for or the willingness of fishermen to participate in the process.
Very good.
We have to make...
We see that good now, right?
Right. Yeah. So that we're working and we're doing well to that end. And but the other side, the flip side of that coin is that the angler enthusiasm will wane, and that we need to incentivize and reward the participation because we have to keep folks on their toes, and we have to keep issues at the forefront, and we have to be willing to try innovative solutions.
Good stuff. And Josh, I know that we kind of gear the program that way, but when we can point people at a website or at a survey, and so obviously some of what you've done this time is going to take a while to compile. When do you anticipate, both of you real quickly, when do you anticipate the fruits of the labor of this last gathering are going to be available?
I would say a report should be out in the next couple of months.
Yeah, yeah.
At the earliest, but we're going to have some stuff on our websites. WPCouncil.org and I think it's FPIR.NOAA.gov.
Oh, in terms of where to go to, and so we're just going through a website transition. So
Get into that, and then we'll get that out.
Right.
And don't be a stranger. We got to see you more than, you know, once every year or two, right?
Oh yeah, that's right. I think that's going to happen actually. So.
Okay, so our thanks once again to everybody for listening. If you want to hear something on the show, particularly on this segment, drop us a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. And you really go to wpcouncil.org and wind your way through that. And remember, you know, that's why this segment was called Improving Opportunity and Stability in Recreational Fisheries. And I know that you might think that you're just not strictly recreational, but you're having fun, but you're eating. And let's hope we can keep that up. We'll be back next time. Have a great day.